Thanks for listening to Health and Happiness, a weekly show broadcasted on Monday evenings and Thursday mornings on KGVM 95.9 or KGVM.org on the internet. I'm Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, together with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. We thank the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association for being a supporter of this program. Especially, we thank Bob Wall, computer guru, for engineering this program. Mental health, social health, physical health, environmental health, spiritual health. It's all tied together. You and I would love to see as many health needs met as possible. Safety and security for all of us. Today's program speaks to one aspect of keeping all of us healthy. Dr. Suzanne now introduces the program.
Hello there. I'm going to bring you some excerpts from an article from the publication High Country News from November 20th, 2023. Bozeman. Connie Howell has lived in Montana for 40 years, nearly half that time in a tan and brick apartment complex in Bozeman. It's always been a pleasant place. But since 2015, the rent for the one-bedroom unit that she shares with her husband, Chris, has nearly doubled. The couple, who depend on Social Security and disability payments, now put about half of their monthly gross income toward rent. Affordable housing, in contrast, is defined as costing no more than 30% of a household's gross income. Howell has seen many friends leave Bozeman because they could no longer afford housing. Her own daughter has been unable to move back here for the same reason. Compared to them, she considers herself lucky, but at age 65, she's scared to death of that luck running out, of something happening to her or Chris, since neither of them could make the rent on their own. I get this thought in the pit of my stomach that just sometimes won't go away, she said. I don't know how I would survive, and I don't know how he would survive. Montana, like much of the country, is experiencing a housing crisis. At the start of 2020, the typical home value was $282,000. Now it's $453,000, a leap of 60%. Renters suffered too. For instance, Helena, the rents jumped 37% in just 2 years. And the rental vacancy rate plunged from the healthy 6.9 it was to just 3.2% availability for rentals. These rapid changes prompted Governor Greg Gianforte, a Republican, to appoint a bipartisan housing task force. The group's recommendations led the state legislature to pass a raft of housing-related bills. The speed and breadth of the changes gathered national attention. Some even called it the Montana miracle. Yet many Montanans who find themselves and their neighbors unhoused, insecurely housed, or fiscally imprisoned in dilapidated digs deride that characterization. They say they're not feeling any miracles. Between 2022, many people wanted to live out their Yellowstone fancy. In Montana, in that time, has added 40,000 new residents, but just 8,700 new homes. Many of those who came were remote workers who brought their incomes with them. So the share of Montana households earning more than $200,000 rose by more than a third in recent years. And as those high earners looked for housing, the cost of material and labor went up and the prices ballooned. According to Kaya Peterson, executive director of NeighborWorks Montana, a decade ago, Montanans could get into a rental, get a job that paid a wage that covered their needs, save up for a down payment, and reasonably buy a home. That formula really doesn't exist in most places anymore, unquote. And many say there's a simple, relatively simple solution: build more housing. But then there are those who argue that more development merely leads to more luxury condos and gentrification. One group, NYU colleagues of Galvez, reported that building more housing can eventually lower prices for low and middle income families. However, that might take years. Montana's legislature passed a slew of measures intended to promote greater and denser development, such as requiring cities to allow duplexes and accessory dwelling units and eliminating minimum lot sizes and parking requirements. They also increased funding for credit to address the shortage of skilled laborers and for infrastructure like sewers and roads. More subdivisions, however, and this is critical, are only half the equation. The other half is making sure that people can afford to live in them. As that NYU researcher wrote, new market rate housing is necessary but not sufficient. Government intervention is critical to ensure that supply is added at affordable prices. And recently, despite a $2.5 billion surplus in the state budget, Montana lawmakers chose not to pass several affordable housing measures during the 2023 session, in spending nearly half of it on tax cuts and rebates, just $106 million was devoted to multifamily housing. Benjamin Patrick Finnegan sees that as a major misstep. Unregulated building of more housing isn't going to ensure that people who live and work in Montana are able to build lives and start families here. The creation of new housing that's affordable has to be our goal. The Republican-controlled legislature voted down several affordable housing proposals, including a housing tax credit, which would have incentivized affordable rental development, and a housing trust fund, which could have subsidized the construction of roughly 500 additional low-income apartments. In November, Montana voters expressed their frustrations by electing one of the tenant group's co-founders as mayor of Bozeman, Joey Morrison, and Andrea Davis, former executive director of Homeward, as the mayor of Missoula. Davis wishes lawmakers had placed a greater emphasis on immediate affordability. We could have helped alleviate some of the pressure. The need is now. Their article concludes, as for whether Montana's new housing strategy will live up to its hype, Davis said, check back in 5 years. If at that point, firefighters and teachers can afford housing, then the state will indeed have pulled off something of a miracle. And so, kind of in a nutshell, there's the problem. But what can you do and I do? How can we have an impact on this deplorable situation. We're so pleased to have with us today Senator J.P. Pomnikowski and Bob Wahl, a couple who are making a difference and a major impact. Along with them is Brian Geyer, who works with housing for HRDC and helps with the program that Bob and JP recently entered. Welcome, guys. We're so happy to have you. And hi, JP and Bob.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hello.
And hi, Brian.
Hi, Suzanne.
Welcome. Tell us how this came about. Maybe, JP, could you tell us how this occurred to you and what you did?
Certainly. And thank you for having us on. My husband, Bob, and I have owned a condo unit in Bozeman for more than a decade. And during that time, we have rented it at far well below going rental costs for a two-bedroom, two-bath, garage, corner, ground floor unit. We've been proud to do that because we know how difficult it was for us decades ago to get into housing in Bozeman. It's only gotten worse since we did it. So while we owned our condo unit, we rented it for a very low price, and our most recent renters were able to pay their rent and save and go on to buy a home. They told us they were moving out and buying a house, and we couldn't have been more delighted for them. But we've had about a decade of renters and decided that we would probably sell the unit. It is very important to us that the unit sell for an affordable price, and that in perpetuity, it stays selling for an affordable price. We did not want to sell for an affordable price to someone who would then flip it for $100,000 or $200,000 profit, which they could have done. So we started looking at deed restricting the property. We wanted to put a limit on it so that it would be owner-occupied and not turn into a short-term rental, for which our gateway to Yellowstone town is famous. And there is a purpose. There's a place for short-term rentals. But we wanted this to be truly workforce housing, people like us and others that have tried to get into a place affordably and have had to leave the town where they work in order to live. So we looked at deed restrictions and what that entailed if we were to try to enforce deed restrictions ourselves. We were recommended to HRDC from a friend and discovered that HRDC's scattered site land trust, which just means that there are, kind of individual homes and condos and other units around the place that are included in the single land trust, has a program that does this very thing. It puts into place deed restrictions. It educates would-be buyers. It qualifies those buyers. It does allow some profit every year, about 2%, I think, on the sale price. So for our $300,000 condo unit, that would be about $6,000 a year. So there can be some gain, but again, it keeps it from being a flipped property. And we were just delighted that HRDC has already worked this out. They have a land trust in place. They work with buyers, and hopefully this serves as a further model for others to use to participate in the HRDC land grant program, or land trust program, I should say.
That is fantastical. I just want to point out, I think Bob and JP could have sold that unit for $425,000 to $450,000, and they sold it for, was it three, JP?
Yes. There is a comparable unit on the market right now for $425,000. We're asking $300,000 flat.
That is purely amazing. And as Bob said, it's not like you're not making a profit, but you didn't need to have that huge leap of a profit that would discomfort everybody else who wanted to get into a place to live. I'm so impressed. Yeah.
We've gotten that question. It's like, well, why would you sell this and lose money? And I want to make it very clear, we are not losing money. We bought the place, 11 years ago, and we're making a very fair profit. It's just not as big a profit as we could make in the current environment. So, I think there's room. There's an intermediate ground there. We don't have to give it away, and we can try to make some effort to sell it at a price that some people could afford. It's still going to be more expensive than some portion of the population would be able to afford, but it's at least getting in the ballpark where, in my mind, I saw this interesting comment the other day about someone talking about another property that was for sale for an astronomical sum. And somebody said, well, that's just a crazy amount. And somebody said, well, why is it a crazy amount? And I was like, it's not. I think we need to stop telling ourselves everything is just about what the market will bear. I mean, there are certain realities that I think we can't ignore. And, a two-bedroom condo for $500,000, I think is, I don't care how many people are willing to pay that for it. I just don't think that that's a workable, a reasonable number. So
we're so impressed and proud of that attitude. And I think a lot of people have the idea that Bozeman is such a wealthy city and that most everybody could easily access housing. This last week, Montana as a state was ranked as having the most homeless individuals of any state. And I just read today that Bozeman is the poorest city in Montana based on the number of people who are struggling. And so what Bob and JP are doing is reaching out to a big segment of the population that really could use that consideration and that help. I noticed in the paper yesterday that the local high school, one of the high schools, kids who hadn't paid their lunch bill, that amounted to $9,000 of unpaid school lunches. There are a lot of people who are struggling, not just for a roof over their head, but food to eat and nutrition. And so I think it behooves each of us to listen to this wonderful act of help and joy with JP and Bob. And Brian, you work within that program and with housing at HRDC. We welcome you back again. You've been on before and we really appreciate that. Tell us about the program and give people in the audience a way to connect, if you could, please.
Sure, happy to. First of all, I want to say thanks for having us on again. And I'll kind of start with HRDC approach to housing in general. We know that housing isn't a monolithic thing. There's a spectrum of housing. And our efforts really do span from homelessness to home ownership. And on the homelessness side, we have the shelters that we operate. We also do rent support and tenancy support services. We have a Housing First Village that we've built for chronically homeless individuals. But then as you sort of move up that spectrum, kind of past the rental supports piece of that into home ownership, the way that we provide support to our customers is through the land trust. And, we do have the oldest land trust in the state of Montana. It was established over on West Babcock in 1993. And so those homes have been in the land trust for that amount of time. And they are really an elegant way to preserve a home's affordability long term. If this isn't just a one-time thing. And I think what really is important to note about JP and Bob's decision to place the home in a land trust is just the durability of a decision like that. this isn't going to just benefit a single family who are fortunate enough to purchase their property, but it will, because of the way the land trust operates, it will benefit all of the subsequent owners of the property as well, which is really beautiful. So it'll benefit literally generations of our community's workforce. And that's really what is so appealing about the land trust, is that a one-time decision can really benefit a community for years and years and years in perpetuity. So it's really just a really terrific way to give back to the community, to demonstrate your support for our local workforce, and also, you know, to Bob's point, you're not walking away empty-handed, walking away with a reasonable amount when you sell a land trust property. You know, there are appreciation caps on those properties, but you still walk away with you know, enough money, hopefully, the way the program's designed. We would hope that you have enough money for a down payment on a market rate home. This is sort of that intermediate step in between renting and market rate home ownership. And, you know, as Bob said, this will benefit the homeowner and the buyer. It's really it's just an elegant way to support our local workforce.
I think it's really interesting. One of the questions that I got when I was first asking people, you know, trying to research how we might do this before, somebody pointed me to the HRDC Land Trust. It's like, well, why don't you just sell it to some friends and just, they'll do, if they tell you they're going to sell it for a reasonable amount, then you could trust them, you know, pick people that you trust. I'm like, we could do that and maybe they would, but if they fell on hard times or when they decide to sell it, all bets are off at that point. And I think it's pretty naive to, if you have this goal in mind, to rely on just the willpower of every subsequent owner to like do what you were hoping. And the land trust model, I think it gives you this legal framework. So it takes all of that guesswork and all of that naivete and hope out of the equation. It just makes sure that the right thing's going to be done into the future.
Brian, I was wondering, what is HRDC's approach, and maybe if somebody in the audience here could comment on maybe the city and the county's approach and the state, but the approach to the many people camping who are essentially homeless, living along the streets in Bozeman. Is there a philosophy, or is it done on a piecemeal basis on how we can help them?
You know, that's a good question. You know, the problem of urban camping, it's such a challenging issue. To Suzanne's point earlier, rental rates in our community and overall just the cost of living have increased so rapidly that it's hard for people in our local workforce to keep up. And the issue of housing instability, the issue of food instability, the issue of affordable childcare, affordable transportation, all of these things, whether we like to admit it or not, all of these things are linked together. And the reality is, you know, with these rising housing costs and costs of living, the people who are most affected by that aren't the people who are purchasing a luxury condominium for the winter, or a luxury home out on the far west side. You know, the people who are impacted by these rising costs are the people who were, I guess, to use an example, are at the on the bottom rung of housing affordability. So people who were living in the affordable rental units on a month-to-month kind of lease, living in mobile home parks, and those are the people who end up urban camping or staying with us at the shelter. They've had the rug pulled out from underneath them. There aren't enough hours in a week to work a job, even at a rate of like $20 an hour. There's just not enough hours in a week for somebody to afford some of the rental rates. And it forces them into a situation where, You know, here are my options. I'm going to either go into the overnight shelter and start staying at the shelter with HRDC, or I have this RV that I've gotten possession of, and I'm going to choose to live in an RV. Our approach is we've got to do better. This isn't something that is emblematic of a community with the resources of Bozeman. And so what our outreach team does with the urban campers is we go out on a daily basis and we try and connect with them. And we originally will start the conversations with, let's get you some food and some warm clothes, and what's your heating situation, trying to figure out if they need propane support or energy support. But then the conversation inevitably shifts to, what are your barriers to housing? Let's have a conversation about what's preventing you from being in a more stable situation than camping on a public street. And, you know, if it's a veteran, let's have a conversation about what benefits you're entitled to that you might be, you know, not collecting. We'll help them go through that paperwork, because that can be a daunting process. Or have you ever thought about a Section 8 voucher that helps people get into situations with more affordable and predictable rent? And so our approach is, let's start with some basics, but really quickly shift that conversation into, what is preventing you from being in a more stable situation? Because we know that there's just living on a public street is not a long-term housing solution, nor is living in a shelter.
Not at all. I had an astonishing conversation with our gym instructor for our exercises about a year and a half ago. They had bought a trailer, young couple, and they've had a couple of kids, and they bought it for $20,000. And then after they fixed it up, they sold it for $80,000. Which was wonderful for them, because they were then able to make a nice down payment on a home. But look how people who are trying to find even an affordable trailer are having to struggle right now.
I think it's worth pointing out the discussion about people urban camping. I think part of the reason that it's so tricky talking about it in the current environment is that there's a fairly significant portion of the population that seems to think, as far as I can tell, that the people that are in that situation are people that just don't want to work, or, you know, they have problems, mental health problems, substance problems or something. And I think there's a distressingly high number of people that just refuse to acknowledge that a significant portion of those people are employed. And, you know, I hear these things, like comments about, you know, maybe we need to provide more disincentives so that they won't be out there camping on the street. Now, and it just makes me wonder, like, what people are thinking, because in my mind, Montana winters, although this winter certainly, aside from that one week or so, hasn't been super difficult, but I would think living in a trailer or a tent in Montana in the winter is more than enough disincentive to want to do that. So
I would add that
I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm. I would add that there is a lot of, I think, misplaced interpretation that somehow housing instability is a quality of someone's character, and that just is not true. So urban camping, especially when I hear from business owners or the more affluent in our community, much like other mountain communities, they disparage urban camping, but this is a result from a circuit court decision that said, if a community cannot support or provide what we like to call the social safety net, basically the services that people need, then if there is no other alternative, people can be allowed to find whatever housing relief they can. And in some cases, that is a camper on a street. It should not be that way. Government and Arliss, you or Dr. Wood, the doctors Wood, had asked about what government might do. Well, local governments in Montana, especially those with really high property values and high property availability rates, accessibility. I mean, that's one thing that I think we should touch on is that housing availability is one thing, housing cost is another. And both prohibit a lot of people from getting into housing in popular Montana markets. Bozeman and Missoula, with self-governing powers, those cities both passed ordinances to try and alleviate and provide more of the housing spectrum that Brian first described. The Montana legislature specifically took, almost verbatim in some cases, those local policies and prohibited them. It was really a punitive act. So I think one of the things that we know about government is that if there are incentives, then people will be rewarded for certain behaviors. We can, and the government in one way does, in several ways, does reward the behavior we want. For instance, if others were to offer their properties at a much lower than fair market value rate, like Bob and I have done, they can take advantage of a tax deduction for a charitable contribution between the difference of the fair market value, the full value, the, you know, $500,000, and the sale price, the much lower sale price. So if people need an incentive more than, will you please try to house your neighbors, there are ways to do it. Another issue, I think, is to elect people who will not try to dismantle the local solutions that Montana governments, self-governing cities and towns, put into place. Don't pull the rug out from the municipalities themselves, who are then trying to serve all of their citizens on that very broad housing spectrum.
Well said. Well said. I know that I had a little fall in the garden a while back and crunched up my elbow. And I had a wonderful young occupational therapist. It's a very wonderful profession and generally well paid. And her husband was a PTR, physical therapy registered person. Together, they felt that they couldn't afford to buy a house in Bozeman, and they were getting ready to leave shortly. So it's when you see something like what JP and Bob have done, it helps everybody. It would help a young couple like those two to be able to get a first home and to know that they could proceed.
Brian?
Yeah.
Regarding those who are living in the campers, regarding the signs I see help wanted all over the place, and with the concept that if we didn't have the workers that we have, even though it's not enough, but they would have to leave because of some onerous government or city rule, what is the percentage of those, as far as we know, who live on the streets, who are employed?
You know, it's a hard number to pin down because we don't really delineate between income that's earned from a job or, for example, Social Security or disability when we check people in. I can tell you that the majority of our guests at the shelter have a source of income, be it Social Security or disability or a job. And it's still, to JP's point, it's not enough to make ends meet. So I get that question quite a bit. And, you know, I can tell you anecdotally,
Our shelter staff are waking up people in the morning, 4 a.m. to get off to work. We have several people who are going off for their early shifts, and we keep our doors open late at night because we have people coming in from second and third shift. And this is not just a few people. This is a good amount of our guests at the shelter are, you know, leaving early and coming in late because they're working, and they're still needing to seek out overnight shelter services. I do want to go back. I think Bob hit on a good thing about a good, it needs to be discussed is the dehumanizing language that people are using towards urban campers and people who are experiencing homelessness. And we really saw that go off the rails up in Kalispell. You know, it started pretty, I think there was a letter from a county commission that kind of went on to social media comments, but eventually that violent language resulted in somebody who was homeless losing their life. And I think we need to understand the seriousness of dehumanizing language when we're talking about urban campers and people who are experiencing homelessness. It can have really life-altering consequences for the people who are experiencing that. And I think a lot of that vitriol, I think it stems, and I hesitate to armchair psychology, but I really do think the seeing people who are experiencing homelessness, who are urban camping, who are really struggling, I think in a way it just reminds people of their own vulnerability because you can see yourself in the people who are urban camping. And, you know, the response when you are kind of, your eyes are opened to your own housing vulnerability is either to villainize those people who are urban camping or like JP and Bob did, make a decision that's going to help your community, that's going to help people who might otherwise be suffering from housing instability find that stability. And I think we have two choices here, and unfortunately I feel like some of that violent rhetoric is winning out over acts of generosity and caring for your neighbors like JP and Bob have done.
I think it's winning out by a huge margin.
But I think the gaining interest in the story about Bob and JP and the HRDC Foundation is gaining a big foothold. We just need to make sure that more and more people are aware of that. And you know, when I think about a hardworking person going to work somewhere, maybe they get $20 an hour at Walmart or wherever, and they go back to a stone cold RV and have to figure out how to warm up, how to eat, and how to sleep for the night. I think we don't give nearly enough kudos to the kind of courage that must take.
Yeah. The irony, I think, Brian, really, that is probably spot on. The irony of the idea that this vitriol comes from the realization that any one of us can be, you know, 2 or 3 months away from being in that situation is pretty thick, I think. But I think it's probably true that that reality is scary. And, you know, I think it raises the level of anxiousness and stuff. And when we get anxious and fearful, sometimes we fall prey to a lot of thought patterns that are like that, you know, to demonize others or to be just to feel some weird need to be angry about things and to try to find an outlet for that. And it's, you know, I wish I knew how to combat that or that somebody did. But
another thing I would add is that, you know, we've had some press, Bob and I have had, but I really wish more of it had just would splash back onto HRDC's land trust, which has been in place for decades now. And if nothing else, this should shine a spotlight on an option that people may not have realized they had. So anyone with a property here who wants to sell is going to be told by their realtor the absolute utmost they can get. And that is a vested interest in a high sale price. So another thing that I think HRDC offers that is a real savings is that there is no realty commission. You don't have to do that. I would dearly love to see realtors and the title companies and the banks with closing costs and everything else. For those participating, if I can just wish this out loud and put it into the universe and someone act on it, waive their fees. If we can make this even more affordable for people. So another of our friends, when we were discussing doing this, said, boy, it would be really tough for me to leave $100,000 on the table. Well, it's not that hard. we're taking a profit. It's not as much as we could have, as Bob had said, but I think there are more savings to be realized here. And so, what might be gained by a realtor taking a commission or a title company running a title search for a property that's been in the same ownership the whole time, or whatever else it is, there are more savings to be realized. And I would hope that we could start to work on those aspects of this too.
And, you know, I think there are other benefits if we had a strong, helpful housing outreach program that welcomed people in and helped them. I know that we needed a car repair recently, and they're so short on people and workers, it was going to be 3 months to get a simple car repair. And we've talked to business owners who are closing the doors because they don't have enough workers. And what we're talking about here, I think, largely could be the worker population that keeps Bozeman running.
Yeah, That, I think, is one of the most important things that I wish was more in the forefront of people's minds when they're thinking about this, is like the consequences are significant. I mean, it's not that hard to predict where this ends up with nobody that, you know, is working in a service job of any kind being able to afford to live here. I mean, where does the community go when you hit that point? I think it goes away.
Yeah, if you don't mind me chiming in, I think you're totally right. I think that, you know, I worked in Park City, Utah, managing a land trust portfolio of about 200 units for many years before I came to Bozeman. And I really felt like the conversation around land trusts really started to shift when we stopped looking at it solely as a housing issue and broadened our discussion to talk about it as this is a local economy issue. You know, a community where you have organizations who are, you know, trying to retain their staff, who are spending a lot of money training people up. You know, these are good company jobs. And then they get to a point where they want to start a family, and there's just no ownership options for people. And that just costs your local businesses so much money in lost wages and having to retrain people and losing that sort of institutional experience that a long-term employee brings. That's eroding your local economy, and it's making it more subject to the whims of, for example, the tourist industry. You know, if Big Sky has a bad year and they have no tourism because the snow's just not there, there isn't a whole lot of local economy to sort of stabilize it. And so you have a lot of really steep ebbs and flows in how your local economy functions because your middle class has been hollowed out and they aren't there to kind of keep things afloat during a down year.
Brian, I would add to that it's ironic to me that a lot of the reasons for which Montana towns are attractive to so many people, low crime rates, great schools, vibrant culture, those are great reasons that people come here, but you don't keep that. You don't keep a good school without good teachers, and you can't keep teachers if they can't live here. You don't keep a vibrant culture if musicians can't afford to stay here or artists. I mean, if firefighters and police officers for public services can't afford to live here, honestly, this can't be a destination with no services. We are a service area. Colorado Springs, Colorado has just launched an effort to build a teacher's tiny home village because they need to house their teachers. They've realized that the school district has realized they have to house their teachers. I think there could be a solution here for that too, and not for businesses just to take profits and call it good. I think there's more of a service they need to provide for their workers who then shore up the businesses, make the businesses succeed. So for the hospital to provide housing, for the school district to provide housing, that's how it used to be. You know, school teachers used to live in the back of the school. I'm not proposing that. I think there should be a separate living space. But
I wouldn't mind it, JP.
But there are other models. There are many other models, and we just have drifted away from them. Another aspect is that a lot of people say, well, if you just work harder, right? See those bootstraps? Well, pull yourself up. Well, a lot of people don't have the boots. And I can tell you, when Bob and I bought our home, we did it by the skin of our teeth. I was working three jobs at once. Bob was on extended work trips. And so, yes, we were able to get barely into a lovely home where we could spend just enough time to catch a quick sleep and shower before we went back out to four jobs. So we realized the struggle. We did not want to contribute to another unit of housing that would be unaffordable. There's a lot of housing inventory coming on in Bozeman and Missoula and other desirable places in Montana, and almost all of it will be outpriced.
I would like to, if I were able to put something out into the universe to for people to mull over, one of my concerns about the new housing that's being constructed and all of these focused efforts during the legislature in particular to streamline the construction of new housing. I know there are a lot of different opinions about how useful that is. I think it seems to me, not being an economist, it seems obvious to me that that's got to be some component. You need to have enough supply to meet the demand. But my concern is that that supply has been and might continue to be gobbled up by people who want to use it as short-term rentals, or even worse, people that are just buying it for an investment and potentially just leaving it sit empty.
Yeah.
I think there's way too much of that happening here. So I think that I really would have loved to see the legislature at least make some substantive discussion about things that could be done to disincentivize that behavior. And I'm not sure what those things might be, but I didn't hear any discussion even about it. And I think that at some point, that's got to be a part of the discussion as well. We need to do everything that we can to make sure that housing is housing for people that live here as much as possible, and not third vacation cabins for people that want to come ski or fish here.
Yes, and, you know, we have a daughter in the film industry, and almost every state, including Montana, has a huge outreach to film companies, incentives to come, and they provide many, many benefits just to bring people in. And I believe that, like you said, JP and Bob, if the legislature would think of some incentives for those working people who would love to come here or who've had to move away because they couldn't afford to be here, if we could provide a package, some legislation that would truly have some impact on this serious problem.
I have a question, JP, Bob, Brian. Is there an option given, pardon me, to people selling their houses that they could put in a land trust? I realize that wouldn't be to the advantage, maybe the realtor or a great profit, but do most people even know about it? Are they, of course, God forbid me saying this in a conservative state, but if they were required to provide that as an option, then it could place their home in the land trust. Is that something people even know about?
I think that, you know, I know the HRDC land trust has done outreach efforts and is working or has worked to have land trust education be allowed as continuing education for realtors so that they would know how to navigate that to somebody who expressed interest. But to Bob's earlier point, it really doesn't benefit them as much financially because they're giving up some of their commission. And so I don't think we have a lot of takers on that. But on a statewide level, there is a statewide land trust called Trust Montana. And a lot of their efforts have been sort of outreach and education because you're exactly right. This is something, I mean, that's beyond realtors. It's just not the most well-known option for people who are selling their home.
It seems anecdotally, you know, just in some of the feedback we've gotten from people hearing about what we're doing, it does not seem to me that most of those people had any inkling that this was an option. And to be frank, you know, when I started thinking about what we could do and started doing research, it's like, you know, I read about programs that maybe preceded this in places like Aspen and Vail, where this problem happened many years ago. And I guess I had known a little bit about the land trust here, but not very much. And I didn't connect the dots. And I sheepishly admit that, man, I sure wish that I had thought a little harder, and that if I had known, I could have saved a lot of my research time and just gone directly to the path where we ended up. And because seriously, the things that we were hoping to accomplish, I guess initially I wasn't quite as focused on the property being owner occupied, but that's certainly not something that I think I didn't want to do. But the program that HRDC has with the land trust was, it did everything that I was hoping. And some things even that I were even harder for me to envision how to do with a deed restriction, like the restrictions on appreciation of the property over time. It's like, well, yeah, we could maybe have waded our way through figuring out how to do that. But it's already, you know, people have already worked that out for us, and they have the legal framework in place and the compliance framework. So if we had decided that we were going to do this on our own and just put deed restrictions on the property, we were faced with the daunting prospect of how would we enforce that going forward in the future? And would we have to bird dog this in perpetuity? And there's an organization that's set up that has that facility in place. So I think it really was eye-opening to me that this was already there. It wasn't something that needed to be built from scratch. It's already out there. And I'm hoping that a lot more people will learn about it. And given the situation that we're in right now, that they will take advantage of it. You know, there are so many people out there that are loudly saying that somebody has to do something about the affordable housing problem here. And they are completely right. But I think
I wonder, Brian, if you could go ahead with your comments and then tell the listening audience how to get in touch with you and the program and give us some ways to link up and check all of this out.
Sure. So the HRDC Housing Land Trust is, as Bob was speaking to, it features a shared equity home ownership structure, which basically bifurcates the land from the improvement on the land, which is actually the house. And the model really allows homeowners to purchase a home at a cost that basically takes the cost of the land out of the equation. And that ownership of that land allows us to do things like put retail restrictions onto it to ensure that the full home is affordable for all the subsequent purchasers. But we can also prevent people from using it as a second home. We can prevent it from becoming an Airbnb property. We can do things like have a local workforce requirement. So there's a certain amount of hours that you need to be working within a certain area to be eligible. But the linchpin of it is the sales appreciation cap. A charity sees appreciation cap, it's 2%, and it's really easy to kind of add 2% onto the purchase price year after year, and you kind of know as a homeowner how much your house is going to be able to sell for. But the logic behind that is we know that, for example, teachers' wages are going to go up at around that same amount, you know, 2, maybe 3% per year. So the income tranche that a land trust home is affordable to in 2024 is going to be the same income tranche that it's affordable to in 25 years. And that's the real beauty of the land trust. If you're interested in participating in HRDC's land trust, you can always reach out to us at thehrdc.org. Mindy DeCoste is our program manager. We actually had two land trust homes sell in the last few months, one in Livingston and one over in our West Babcock Land Trust. So they do come up on the market every so often. So I encourage you to go to thehrdc.org to see what properties are available. But reach out to Mindy and have a conversation about some of the benefits. JP mentioned, you know, that you do, there's some tax benefits to it. It's not a loss at all for a homeowner to put their home into a land trust, and it certainly benefits the community for a long time.
Brian, it sounds like that you have summed up well this program, but we have another couple of minutes. Bob, JP, what would you all say in summary here?
Well, I wanted to add one point, and that is that especially in our very desirable Southwest Montana area, we draw a lot of people to a beautiful environmental area, and there's been a lot more focus and I think support for other types of land trusts to preserve trails and public spaces, put conservation easements to keep view sheds protected, all that kind of thing. This is a different type of land trust, and it is, I would say, more valuable. If we can't keep a spectrum of people in our community, we should be a destination for ourselves as well as others.
I would just like to encourage as many people as possible to look into this program if they have property, if they own property, and seriously look at what they can do to be part of the solution instead of expecting some outside force, the government or whoever, to magically, you know, do this. People have the power to actually make significant inroads in this under their own volition, and I hope that people will do so.
JP, Brian, Bob, we thank you for being with our program today. Health and Happiness, this has been terrifically impressive in its knowledge given to the citizens. We ask that you listen to KGVM 95.9 and especially Health and Happiness on Monday evening and Thursday mornings. Thank you again for listening. Goodbye.